This is the Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Great to have your company this Friday lunchtime. Coming up, a growing number of farmers in central Queensland are setting up operations off the energy grid for cost, independence and emissions reduction. And it's seeing some decent savings.
If we went down the road of tapping into our power, it would have cost us about $60,000, give or take. We probably saved, I think we spent about $30,000.
Now, Bubs Australia, it's come from a Sydney kitchen to a global supermarket shelf near you. It's won the 60th Australian Export Awards. You'll hear from that company. It exports to China and has also cracked the US market as well. Also closer to 1 o'clock, you'll meet a farmer who's accidentally grown restricted pharmaceutical poppies. More on that story about that florist who hoped to provide poppies for wedding season, but instead of brides coming and knocking, it was in fact the authorities. To some breaking news now, and the Queensland Land Court has recommended against granting applications for Clive Palmer's Waratah coal to mine in the Galilee Basin. We'll bring you more as soon as we have those details. First today, bills are mounting at this time of year, and some tough decisions have to be made. I saw one set of figures showing sales are expected to reach $6.2 billion for the four-day cyber weekend we're currently in. Aussies plan to spend an average of $1,350 this holiday season, $400 being spent on gifts alone. So, of course, that's discretionary spending. You can choose to go without it. But what if you're a horticulture business and it's the fixed costs that are sky high, showing no sign of stopping? How do you try and save to remain viable when the best deal you can negotiate means an added $150,000 to your power bill? Belinda French says there are price increases in her Gold Coast hydroponics business at every corner, and it's not just the increased power price that's pinching.
So you anticipate the big stuff. You know, obviously labour increases, then you've got energy costs that everybody obviously is aware of. That's, you know, quite well covered in the media. But getting right back down to the bare basics of the business, we're even looking at our cleaning products being increased by 8%. Now, these are increases that you just don't think are going to occur, especially after the communication around it being, you know, the getting shipping into Australia and not being able to get products and availability. But the input costs are just not settling down. They're not finding a base and a medium at the moment. So it's literally everything that you can think of within the business is increasing, and the absorption of those increases is just not viable.
So how much are we talking here? You mentioned in the dry goods category, cleaning products. How much has that increased?
That increases 8%. Now, that's on top of increases in the last 12 months as well. We just renewed our energy plan as well, just came off a four-year plan. We went from tariff rates of 8 to 9 cents up to now 25 cents. So that's an increase across the board of about 150,000 a year. And we knew there were increases coming, but didn't realise the actual size of them and the impact that that would have. And I mean, we're operating cool rooms and processing machinery 24/7. So we don't have the capacity to just turn things off, or, you know, we're looking to switch and save with solar. But once again, that's potentially only going to take $20,000 off the bill. So this is all margin impacting.
And that, I would assume, is the best deal you could get in terms of the tariff that you're on, seeing an increase of $150,000. You're saying you could switch to solar, but that might only save $20,000. What other things could be done? Where do you make up those costs?
Well, it's actually coming to the point in time that you can't, you know, we're transporting all of our goods, so we have our diesel increases as well with our fleet of trucks. It is literally just eating into margins at the moment. It comes to a point that we need to accept the fact that we can't produce the same amount of product for the base price that we have been. There has to be increases across the board. Growers are working really, really hard to mitigate that risk and to try and decrease costs wherever possible. You throw in weather to that, and the fact that, you know, we've all had, you know, amazing rainfall, and up until now it's had significant impact across the industry, but now we're back irrigating, so you've got the energy costs associated with that as well. So coming into Christmas, all businesses in horticulture and across agriculture will be concentrating, obviously, on reducing costs to ensure that we can keep costs down for consumers. But at the end of the day, the new reality is we have a price point that we have to rise and meet so that our businesses can be profitable and sustainable for the long term.
Before we get to that price paid in the supermarket, just back to energy consumption on farm. And of course, you'll have done an energy audit. You'll have tried to minimise costs wherever you can.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So there wouldn't be a business out there that's not turning off the lights and making sure that they're capturing every bit of spend. I mean, in terms for us, we only run what we need to at the times. We try and start up at different hours so that we've got different tariffs that we're working off, and all of these things are in place, but they've been in place for a long time. We've been energy conserving for a long time in our businesses. We've all been aware of it. But, you know, when you're tripling the cost of energy, there's only so much that will actually achieve.
And what about avenues in terms of innovation with production and increasing production? Is there any margin to be made there?
Oh, absolutely. Look, we're looking at putting in a new intensive horticulture side to the business in the coming 6 months. Now, the lead behind that is actually weather, first and foremost. We've lost so much crop in the last 12 months that it's no longer viable to grow the way that we are. So in terms of climate change, we have to adapt for that purpose. The offshoot of that is that we will be able to produce more plants in every square metre to get more out of our energy usage and our input costs as well. So that will bring about, you know, a significant cost saving in the business and a new way of thinking.
So Belinda France, is that a protected cropping project?
It is. So we've got Cravo coming over from Canada and moving gully systems going in middle of next year, and that will see a huge input to the business in terms of raw materials and our capacity to keep costs down wherever we can.
This takes us back to the price point for horticultural products, and it is a very complicated situation and the way that's determined depending on how your produce goes to market. But do you think more broadly there is something that has to change in terms of what the consumer is willing to pay? Is that the angle this has to come from?
Absolutely. I think it's the fact that we need to respect the cost, the input cost that goes into the production of that plant. So other than producing a packet of chips in a controlled environment where there's energy costs that we've all, you know, been made aware of in the media recently, a plant grown in the environment has so much more impact around the weather and the control points around fertilising and irrigating. And it's no longer that we can just grow our plants for a certain cost. The cost point has increased, and therefore there has to be an acceptance that there is a price increase for fruit and vegetables. But I think more as a consumer as well, we need to celebrate that and celebrate the fact that recognising that growers work really, really hard to reduce those input costs and sustain that price that we have for so long. But we're dealing, like every household, with these unprecedented increases, and there needs to be a flow on so that we can remain in a sustainable, profitable space and continue what we're doing. And that, in the sentiments around the industry at the moment, is the most important conversation that we want to have with consumers, is that when you do see a price increase, recognise the fact that it is real, and that other than the weather implications, we have this long-term input cost increase that we're trying to deal with.
Some news for you today in an industry sense also. You're stepping away from the AusVeg board after 7 years on that board, four of those as the deputy chair. What legacy do you think you've left within the industry as part of that lobby?
Look, I feel like I have been part of a new wave, a new generation of industry bodies and the way that we represent growers in a really robust capacity. A really strong industry body that's whole of industry rather than just streams. We are united. We are all speaking from the same sheet now. We're proactively engaging with government. We're working really hard to raise our profiles and create a really robust, strong industry moving forward for next generation, which I think now as I'm sort of getting into the older grower categories, which is quite nice, where I started off in the young group, is that we're handing over something that's strong, sustainable, and will really create a new space for our new growers coming through.
That's Belinda France. She's from Coastal Hydroponics. It's inland of the Gold Coast, talking about ending her tenure with the lobby group AusVeg, but earlier talking about some of the increases in fixed costs, like her power bill being increased because she's on a different tariff to $150,000. Well, speaking of power, what about going off-grid? It's been a long-held situation on places, perhaps more remote, that they have sought their power off-grid. But in central Queensland, some relatively new farms have started up in semi-urban areas and are choosing to be off-grid from the get-go. ABC Capricornia's Katrina Bevan found out the reasons why.
They come through them pretty good.
They do, don't they?
Yep.
Roxanne Hinton is getting ready to harvest finger limes on her farm near Emu Park on the Capricorn coast.
Yep. That one for your lunchbox.
Yeah.
The farm, which was set up in 2018, has 1,500 trees and operates with solar power completely off-grid. Roxanne and her husband Luke opted for the setup for both independence and cost.
So if we went down the road of tapping into our power, it would have cost us about $60,000, give or take. We probably saved, I think we spent about $30,000 with the setup, and a lot of generosity too, of a lot of friends and family helping with that too. But we did, our savings was incredible. So we're very happy with that road we went down.
There's a diesel generator on the property that usually kicks in around 10 o'clock at night when they have events, which are usually weddings.
So this initially was our production shed, and it was sitting there not doing much while our fruit was growing. So we decided to jump on another angle and do weddings. So we are booked out for the next 2 years. So we will be building another shed exactly like this for our production.
The pair are hoping to expand into international markets in 2024. Not far down the road in Yeppoon, Ross O'Reilly's High Valley Dawn permaculture farm is also self-sufficient in energy. In the last 5 years, the bush block of more than 50 hectares has been transformed to include a market garden, food forest and some livestock.
Yeah, we wanted to be off-grid. We intended to be off-grid. Just for those reasons, you know, for food security and energy, but also to educate. And we do a lot of education here with daycare groups, homeschooling groups, kindergartens, primary schools, secondary schools. The university comes through regularly. Yeah, well, we've got our four dams along the valley floor. We solar pump. We use the sun's energy to pump it up 28 metres high up on the hill. Got three big tanks up there, 25,000 litre tanks. And then we use the law of gravity to distribute that through our gardens and food forests and bush tucker forests. And we've also then got a dam on our desalination plant. That is just there now to drought-proof the property. If we need to use that again in drought, well, we've got it there. We know that it works, and, yeah, that'll get us through.
That natural desalination plant involves bore water flowing through salt-hungry vegetation and limestone, reducing its salinity. The property also has an underground fridge that will soon be used to process the farm's produce. It's essentially a shipping container covered in soil and vegetation that naturally stays at a cool temperature. To set up as fully off-grid, including with irrigation, Ross estimates it cost around $70,000.
Probably we use roughly about 17,000 kilowatts of energy a year, which equates to, you know, $4,500 worth of energy, you know, electricity costs that we save every year.
Melanie and Rob Leather run around 5,000 cattle across three properties in central Queensland. One property has always been off-grid, out of necessity because of its remote location. The other two properties, while on-grid, have a large number of solar pumps. There's 37 across the three properties, with five more to be installed next year. They pump anywhere from 60 to 100,000 litres of water a day, of distances up to 4 kilometres. With a green bank loan, they spent around $250,000 on the solar pumping systems and a similar amount on the pipelines, holding tanks and trough systems.
The work that we've done around the water infrastructure and particularly the solar systems and being able to fence those dams or put solar systems on them with holding tanks and troughs, it's going to really make us a lot more resilient during these periods of dry that we're getting, because we are getting more extreme climatic events. So definitely the infrastructure we've put in place will, you know, set us up well to ensure that we've always got good, clean water supply for our cattle.
That model, incorporating renewables while staying on grid, is something advocacy group Farmers for Climate Action supports. In its recent Farm Powered report, the group called for government-set targets for agriculture renewable energy use, more incentives for on-farm renewables like subsidised on-farm batteries, and for farmers' export limits to the grid to be scrapped. One of the report's authors is Karen Stark, a cotton and wheat farmer in the central west of New South Wales.
It is a concern if more and more consumers or farmers go off grid, because then the overall cost for our network that needs to be paid for gets washed over less and less customers, and that ends up increasing the price of their electricity bills. So there's an equity issue that also needs to be considered if you want to go off grid, those electricity costs and network charges are then going to be paid by everyone else. So we need to prevent people from exiting, if possible, give them incentives for staying, and make sure that's a valuable, the distribution network is a valuable asset for people, that they can export the excess power that they're producing, particularly farmers that might only use that power at certain times of the year, and be able to share that with neighbours or trade it with the community.
Going off-grid is something more farmers are considering, according to the Queensland Farmers Federation. The group's energy project manager, Andrew Chamberlain, says the body has done lots of work in the last few years looking for ways its members could save on energy, as well as investigating microgrids.
Fundamentally, I think with the electricity networks are a great piece of infrastructure, and I think it offers those opportunities for farmers to share power and not have to invest in all the infrastructure they need to generate all their own power all the time, which they need if they go off-grid. But it is difficult to convince farmers at times when they're facing increasing charges and reliability issues to stay on the grid and wait for those models to come forward. But, you know, we've been working on projects that develop evidence to show that those models will work. We just need to work with our networks and regulators to sort of allow those models to start to be adopted.
The federal government says it's committed $20 billion to modernise the electricity grid, and its Clean Energy Finance Corporation has invested more than $300 million in 20 agriculture projects.
Katrina Bevan ending that report, and you can watch the story in full on Landline this Sunday from 12:30, or you can catch up later on iView. Now, there's been a bit of rain, about 82 millimetres on the Eaglefield marker. That's sort of near Mount Coolin, and then the further east you go, southwest of Mackay, West Plain Creek Road had 168 millimetres, around Serena 128 millimetres. That was Maguire's Road Alert. We'll talk to the Bureau after 12:30 to find out more. 22 past 12.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, the infant formula company Bubs Australia has taken out a national award for Best Australian Exporter. Bubs cracked the US market this year when there was a dramatic shortage of infant formula there, and they've got a significant footprint into the Chinese market. David Claughton spoke to the CEO and founder, Christy Carr, this morning after they received the award in Canberra last night. And she was pretty excited.
We won!
No, you're joking.
It was quite overwhelming, really, with all those wonderful Australian businesses in the room. But we did. Bubs Australia won the Agribusiness Food and Beverage Award category, but also the overall exporter of the year.
That is a big night. Does it come with a huge cash prize?
No, I don't know about that, but it comes with a very beautiful Dinosaur Designs award, so a trophy, and we have two of them, but they're the nicest trophies I've ever seen, so that's got to be added to the pool room.
All right, so that it was a big night for you. Were there celebrations afterward?
Absolutely, yes. We had we continued on and celebrated at Parliament House, but we also came back and had a little sneaky bottle of champagne between the executive leadership team to sort of reflect on the year that's just been.
It has been an extraordinary year, wasn't it? Because you ended up filling this massive gap in the American market.
It was, and You know, we really, I guess, have got our, you know, delivered our first chapter of growth in China, and everything had gone from strength to strength there after initial, you know, a very significant disruption in the early onset of the pandemic. And then in the last year, we really saw an opportunity to accelerate our entrance into the American market. And, you know, that was quite a unique period of time for the American infant formula category, as it was spiraling into a crisis with a shortage of infant formula. So
you were the first company, I think, globally, weren't you, to be given accreditation?
We were the first company globally to apply, and I think that's a true testament of Bubs family's team's agility. So we were the first application in the world to be admitted, and we were the second manufacturer in the world to be accepted into the enforcement discretion policy. So
how did that play out? Because I remember speaking to you, you know, when that was, you know, that when you achieved that result, did you end up selling a lot of infant formulas through the US?
Yeah, absolutely. We've just sent over our 1 millionth tin, actually. So it's been quite a big couple of months, and we've sold a large majority of that inventory that we've sent to the US into all of the sort of big box retailers over there. So we're now ranged in 6,500 stores across 42 states. Just really see it as a long-term opportunity. So we've set up a team and an office in Los Angeles and setting up the business for a long-term success.
Wow. How many people employed at the company now?
So far, 12 in America, 75 across the globe. So we also have offices in Shanghai and in Sydney and Melbourne. So,
and with so much product going to the States now, have you had to increase, you know, the base of, you know, your source material, the inputs?
Well, absolutely. So none of that sort of accelerated growth had been forecasted. So we really needed to call on all of our farmers and suppliers. And you know, it certainly couldn't have been done if we didn't have our own manufacturing facility down in Victoria in Dandenong South. So we've been really operating there at full capacity, which is three shifts a day, 24/7 for the first few months to get that product produced. And now we're just continuing to bring forward our forecast to supply that demand.
And what about suppliers? Where are you drawing from now?
So still all of our long-term supply partners, many of whom are based in Victoria from our dairy farmers. But we work with Australia's three largest dairy manufacturing companies, actually, Fonterra, Barra and Bega. And we have three ranges of infant formula products across three different milk sources, organic goat milk and A2 protein milk as well. So, you know, we've not only sort of diversified our markets, but we've also diversified our product portfolio offering, which is very helpful during these times where supply chain is challenging.
That's Christy Carr of Bubs Australia speaking there with David Claughton. And the awards were handed out by the Australian Trade and Investment Commission and the Australian Chamber of Commerce. Now, in Queensland winners news, Morton Co. were named as the Australian Export Awards Regional Exporter winner for 2022. In a statement, Charlie Mort believes recognition at the Australian Export Awards will allow the company to diversify its export markets. Mr. Mort says it also recognises the work of Mort's staff who ensure our international customers receive a high-quality product. 28 past 12.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Another farewell today. After 7 years at the head of the Food Agribusiness Network on the Sunshine Coast, Emma Greenhatch has chaired her last AGM. Called a cluster group, the not-for-profit organisation has more than 370 members from Gympie to Moreton Bay, including primary producers, food manufacturers, retailers, restaurants and cafes. As Jennifer Nichols reports, the CEO leaves her position 1 week after seeing Fan inducted into the Sunshine Coast Business Awards Hall of Fame.
I think back to when Fan started 7 years ago, and one of my measures of success back then was I'd seen so many organisations like Fan rise and fall with you know, one person driving it and then they leave and it all falls over. And I had a goal for myself back then that FAN would always be about its members and its community, its industry, its regions. And we're the stewards of that, the team and the board. And it was a really proud moment today listening to Nicole, who's going to be acting CEO for the next 6 months.
Nicole McNaughton.
Yes, Nicole McNaughton, talking about what's in store for 2023 and owning that space as she so deserves to. And so whilst I'm sad to say goodbye today, it feels amazing that there's an incredibly committed team in place, a strong membership, a strong board, and I know the future for FAN will be really bright.
That's the outgoing CEO of the Food Agribusiness Network, Emma Greenhatch. Thanks very much to our reporter, Jennifer Nichols, on the sunny coast. We're coming up on the Country Hour. We're talking about a little bush fair that's been running for, let me get this right, around 26 years. I've got that right. For crafty people from remote parts of this state to come to a fair to do a bit of Christmas shopping. That's coming up for you now, though. Ellie Bradfield, what's making rural news?
Hi, Ali. Investigations are continuing after a woman in her 60s suffered serious injuries on a property on the Southern Downs yesterday. The woman had her legs and one arm amputated following an incident with a slasher at Ballandine. She was flown to the Princess Alexandra Hospital in a critical condition. Workplace Health and Safety Queensland and the Forensic Crash Unit will investigate the incident. An Australian government agency where a male staff member allegedly urinated on his colleagues will have its culture examined by an independent review. Agriculture Minister Murray Watt has ordered the review of the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. Questions about AMFA's workplace culture were raised before a Senate estimates hearing at Parliament House earlier this month. Wilmar Sugar says it's investigating the cause of an incident at its Inkerman mill yesterday morning that saw five employees taken to hospital. A laboratory at the mill was evacuated and a Wilmar spokesperson says one person was exposed to chemical fumes. Five employees were taken to hospital for respiratory issues but were all discharged a few hours later and the lab has since reopened. The incident's not believed to have been caused by a gas leak. Ali, more news at one.
Thanks very much, Ellie. Straight to the Weather Bureau. Steve Hadley is holding the line. He's the senior forecaster there. Hello, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon, Ali.
Plenty going on yesterday afternoon. There were some extraordinary falls in that sort of southwest of Mackay region, I think around Serena. Yeah. There was a big fall. Plain Creek, yeah. West Plain Creek Road, that might have been the best.
Yeah, I think about 168 millimetres picked up at West Plain and 128 millimetres at Serena. But in some parts of the inland central coast, I think West Plain and Socorridge and Weir were the two places that I was looking at, that actually had around 70 to 75 millimetres just in 1 hour yesterday afternoon. So, yeah, some really heavy, intense and fairly localised. You know, the heaviest stuff was fairly localised in terms of the downpours through there. And it was kind of associated with some instability in central to northern Queensland with a trough, but also a bit of a weak surge in the winds moving up the east coast. And it's moved further up east coast and into further north of North Queensland today. So things calming down, easing a little bit in Central Coast for the time being. So today I think the heavier falls will probably be more around Charters Towers up through Georgetown sort of area, still in northeastern Queensland, and still the risk of some locally heavy downpours in that region this afternoon, Ollie. So yeah, just take care if you're out in that area this afternoon, and we'll keep you posted if there is a need to issue any more warnings.
And just looking at the Townsville radar loop right now, there's a bit of action on there, particularly usual spot.
There is a little bit of action up there, isn't there? Yeah, too. That's another little watch point area around that southern end of the North Tropical Coast and Herbert Burdekin area. So Hinchinbrook and Ingham, Lucinda, that sort of area. We think that one of the little surges in the wind is in through that area, and it is quite unstable. So another watch point will be through the next 12 to 24 hours, you know, going through this afternoon and into tonight, whether we get any localised heavy rainfall on that coast down there as well. So, yeah, some of the modelling that we're looking at is pointing at some very localised falls in excess of 100 millimetres down there over the next 24 hours.
Mm. Well, that's not to be sniffed at, over 100 millimetres.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And, you know, as we saw yesterday, you get quite a lot of that in a short amount of time. So obviously the that part of the world does naturally get a lot of rainfall in short spaces of time sometimes. So the warning thresholds are just that bit higher up there. But, you know, it has been really dry lately, so it could become a bit of a surprise if you're not expecting it. So, yeah, just keep an eye on that weather radar over the next few hours.
Well, and Queensland became flood-free in terms of those official flood warnings from the Bureau. What will the weekend hold, though? We know things are really saturated and there is some rain due. Could that change things?
Yes. So I think over the weekend, the main watch area for the showers and thunderstorms initially will be in northern and eventually northwestern Queensland. Not too much happening southwest of about Mount Isa to Longreach to Charleville through the weekend. Just a very slight risk of storms in the southwest, more especially Sunday. But with the trough coming through from the west again, we could see things starting to perk up again through more central parts of inland Queensland. So sort of talking about sort of Longreach to Emerald sort of area, maybe down into the areas east of Charleville and Roma, and then potentially some very isolated storms getting into the Downs region on Sunday as well, and possibly even into areas of the east coast south of about Bundaberg. So, just some more isolated activity through that part of the world, but it is potentially going to happen over some areas which have recently flooded. So, you know, if you do get a heavy downpour, that could cause some localised flash flooding down through that part of the world, with the ground being a bit wetter through this recent period of rainfall. It's really into early next week, though, where things start to change across northern, central and eastern Queensland. A higher risk of flooding going into next week, Arlie, eventually. So I think with the continued quite a wet week for the Downs next week, with showers and storms around for most of the week, so we could see things changing through the week. I'm pretty sure the details will emerge a little bit clearer over time because the models are showing some differences in what they're depicting for the rainfall next week. But as I was saying, wet week for the southeast, including Dying Downs in those areas which have recently got through some flooding. So potentially we could see some renewed river level rises at some stage during next week in some of those river systems down there. And also through the remainder of Queensland as well, especially the east and the north, continued top-ups of rainfall through next week. So there could be some decent falls around looking through that Monday to Friday period, even along the east coast. So from from Sunday, it's mainly inland parts and from and northern Queensland. And then from about Monday, we're looking at anywhere along the east coast, potentially seeing some good rainfall through next week. And with the potential that we might see a coastal trough developing about the middle of the week. So some parts of the central coast and even the central inland through to the central highlands and coalfields could see a risk of some heavier rainfall and, you know, maybe some concerns with flash flooding through there, through, you know, particularly through the middle part of the week. But yeah, looking a long way ahead at this stage. So we'll keep an eye on it over the next few days and keep you posted, especially as we go into the early part of next week.
I might say the total forecast rainfall for the 8 days looks somewhat of a rainbow, with the top sort of fall forecast being around the tip, and then it goes all the way to the far southwest where there's no forecast rain for that. But quite significant rain over the next,
Yeah, there's a good spread on our rainfall maps on the agricultural part of the site, with around 50 to 100 millimetres through anywhere east of what's probably about Dummagee to Emerald to Toowoomba, east of there, 50 to 100 millimetres. So, you know, that indicates that things are really going to change quite significantly next week. And when we look at those, you know, individual models and sort of collate them together in those pictures, it sometimes doesn't show up some of the localized heavier falls that you're also mentioning. So, you know, if it wouldn't be out of the question for some places to see a few hundred millimeters next week. The big question is, you know, where that's going to be and when it's going to be at this stage. So, yeah, we'll have to keep you posted on that one, Arlie.
We'll tap into it next week, though, but chance of cyclones, is it too early to be talking about that? Never too early. Yeah, well, we're in Queensland, of course.
You know, why not just let it all happen just as summer starts? So, yeah, we're going into the early part of December. Tropical cyclone season is underway. So we've got that risk as well at this time of year, particularly for the tropical areas of the state, but not only. It looks as though some of the longer term modelling, if you have a look at that, that it is showing a bit of an increasing risk for the regions to our north. Later next week. So potentially the northern region and maybe including the Gulf of Carpentaria could see a tropical low or some kind of system, maybe even a tropical cyclone by next weekend. But such a large variation in what the models are saying that I think at the moment, you know, the risk is very low for the next 7 days and then potentially from Friday onwards becoming a little bit greater than that. So maybe into the low scale. But we'll, again, keep you posted on all of that through the coming week.
Steve Hadley, thank you very much for that wrap-up.
Thanks, Ali.
Have a nice weekend. Cheerio. Senior forecaster at the Bureau. That's Steve Hadley.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Let's update you now on the breaking news that occurred at the beginning of the program, because the Queensland Land Court has recommended against granting applications for Clive Palmer's Waratah coal to mine in the Galilee Basin in Queensland. Jade Toomey is the ABC reporter covering the story. Hello, Jade.
Hey there, how are you going?
Very well. Tell me, Jade, what reasons did the Land Court give for this decision?
I guess the first thing to remember in this case is it's the first time that an application has been objected to, a mining application has been objected to on the basis that it would infringe on human rights. And that was the key focus of this particular case, whether human rights would be limited by the mining applications' contribution to climate change. And in this case, the president of the Queensland Land Court actually said that the mine would unjustifiably limit human rights in this particular case. So it's a pretty huge concept, I suppose, to take in at this stage. And given that we have only literally in the last kind of half an hour learnt of this, there is obviously a huge amount of information to go through. But in essence, the applications, both the mining lease and the environmental approval applications, have been recommended not to be approved by the Queensland Land Court.
And we have a grab here of Fleur Kingham from the Queensland Land Court.
Yeah, she's the president of the Queensland Land Court, and let's see what she had to say today about why she made that decision.
I've decided the importance of preserving the right, given the nature and extent of the limitation, weighs more heavily in the balance than the economic benefits of the mine and the benefit of contributing energy security. Contributing to energy security for Southeast Asia.
Now that's Fleur Kingham, the president of the Queensland Land Court. We're speaking to our reporter in Townsville, Jade Toomey. Jade, we do appreciate this has just broken. And of course, in terms of reactions, they mightn't have come to pass. But the significance of this decision, can you walk us through that?
Yeah, essentially this particular case was brought by a First Nations-led youth activist group, and they have always in their application put First Nations rights at the forefront, and they essentially have said that the cultural rights and the human right for First Nations people to be able to practice their cultural rights, preserve culture and evolve culture on their land is something that needs to be considered in mining applications. So going forward, essentially what land court decisions mean is that the president of the land court in this case would make a recommendation to the minister in charge of the respective legislation. So in this case, it's the Minerals Act and the Environmental Protection Act in Queensland. So that means that President Kingham makes her recommendations to the Queensland Resources Minister, Scott Stewart, and to the Queensland Environment Minister, Megan Scanlon. And they will essentially have final say on whether or not to grant this mining lease application and this environmental approval application. So that is where kind of all eyes will be turning to now. But the fact that human rights, climate change and mining have all been linked as being kind of a cause and effect effect in this particular decision is actually, you know, pretty huge and really would open the floodgates to different sorts of applications now being made on the basis of human rights, given that that has really never happened before.
Jade Toomey, thank you so much for that. Thanks for being across this story from our Townsville newsroom.
Thank you.
Just repeating that news, the Queensland Land Court has recommended against granting an application for Clive Palmer's Waratah coal to mine in the Galilee Basin in Queensland. We'll go from coal mining to Christmas shopping next.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Because 26 years ago, a group of crafty women from remote Western Queensland decided to put on a bit of a do ahead of Christmas. They wanted to showcase the incredible talent of Outback artisans. Fast forward to today, and that do is now an annual exhibition, attracting thousands of visitors, and it's known as Bush Christmas. Landline reporter Courtney Wilson went to check it out.
In a workshop a long, long way from the North Pole, there's a little bit of magic happening.
All right, here's another one.
15-year-old Charlotte Cross is busy making birdhouses with her dad, Dion.
That's good. We'll whack some screws in there, right?
Yep. Dad has always built stuff and I've watched him and wanted to create something, so he helped me. We just started cutting wood and got little trinkets and we're like, let's just make a birdhouse.
The birdhouses are made from salvaged and recycled wood. No two are the same. At first, Charlotte began building birdhouses just because she wanted to make something and maybe also make a little bit of money by selling that something.
It was all online and we only put 7 on there and it sold in the first couple of minutes. I didn't realise it was going to blow up that much, so I was like, oh wow, it's happening.
Charlotte's dad, Dion, is an artist and sculptor. Under his guidance, the teenager has learnt a whole raft of new skills.
I learnt how to use most of the tools in the shed I never knew, but Dad helped me along the way. Now I can use most of them by myself.
Oh, pretty heavy, that one.
That one is really heavy.
To cap off a big year for her little business, Charlotte's been invited to exhibit her birdhouses at Bush Christmas in Toowoomba.
Bush Christmas is so well known, I think there probably wouldn't be too many people in the country that hadn't heard of it in some shape or form.
Would you like a bag today? Yeah.
The event is an annual celebration of Outback creative talent. Bush Christmas runs for 10 days and gives visitors the chance to support rural artisans by buying unique handmade goods made by people from regional Australia.
It's really quite amazing how there's just so many people doing so many wonderful things.
This year marks 26 years since the very first Bush Christmas. Liz McClymont is the original organiser. She was living in Western Queensland and was involved with her local craft shop when she had the idea to start Bush Christmas back in 1996.
We knew different people who were doing things. We knew there was a craft shop at Longreach and we knew a few of the people up there had contacts. There was another one, I think, around Augathella. There were a few scattered around, and so one thing led to another, and we sort of gathered up a few people who were interested.
26 years later, the gathering has become a bit bigger.
We started off with 17 exhibitors. There was lovely fabric hats. There was also the home cooking, which was sort of professionally home done. We had Christmas cakes and jams and pickles and all those sort of things.
Today there are more than 100 exhibitors from all over Australia.
We have a process where they can freight their things in. It all has to arrive on a certain time. Then we unpack it, we display it, we do everything, because if those people were to come down themselves, then in many cases they wouldn't be able to do it.
Karen McVeigh lives on a property in Jimbor, about 30 kilometres from Dalby on Queensland's Western Downs.
I've been involved with Bush Christmas this will be my 18th year. Well, there's really nothing like it. I guess it gives people who are in a rural area just another outlet to showcase what they might be doing.
Baking for Bush Christmas is no mean feat, though.
One big year was probably close to 900 items, so 900 boxes of things, but I won't be able to make that record again.
every piece of art and craft and cooking and everything that comes into Bush Christmas has a special barcode, and that barcode, we have to generate the barcode, send them to the exhibitors, they put them on, they send the work in. So there's a lot of behind the scenes work to make it the spectacular that it is.
Wendy Allen officially took over the organising role last year. The hard work, she says, is all worthwhile for the chance to celebrate and promote rural and remote artisans.
I'm blown away probably just about every day that you see somebody doing something really amazing and so many original ideas as well.
In remote areas, some years are more difficult than others when it comes to making ends meet. Whether it's drought, fire, or this year floods, there are many challenges. So the chance to make a bit of extra money out of their artistic pursuits is a very welcome opportunity.
A lot of people rely on the income that they make from Bush Christmas, from their arts and crafts and gourmet, to supplement their income during the year.
For shoppers too, the chance to support rural and remote communities and pick up a beautifully made gift is a gift in itself. Though they don't actually count heads, Wendy says they estimate, based on sales, about 10,000 visitors will come through the doors over the duration of the 10-day event.
Have you been to Bush Christmas before?
Bush Christmas gives people lots of exposure because of the reputation that's built up over the last 25 years of people know and people come from far and wide.
That's Wendy Allen from Bush Christmas. Ending that story from Landline's Courtney Wilson, a couple of disclaimers at this point. My uncle supplies his wood-carved products to this event, and my husband's aunt and her family supply jojoba products to Bush Christmas too, and I've already been twice. And luckily yesterday won the ICPA raffle, which was a wonderful hamper, including a lot of products from Bush Christmas. I reckon it's worth getting to, but you can watch the full story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30 or any time, of course, on ABC iView. Well, bush tucker like finger limes and Davidson plums are already making their way into more Australian households, and the alcohol industry is one of the most recent markets to open up to these native fruits. But with more demand comes a need for more supply, and some growers think bush food production is still a niche space. Ashley Bagshaw has this report.
For Pioneer Valley chef Nick Flack, creating alcohol out of bush tucker is an industry he got into by pure coincidence. He says it all started when local native fruit grower Jock Hansen came to his restaurant with too many finger limes.
Jock had a bit of a glut going back probably 2.5 years ago now, and he rocked up to the restaurant with about 15, 20 kilos of finger limes, and he said, "Oh, Chefo, what are you going to do with these? They're all yours." And I was like, "Oh, mate, I don't know, I'm going to have to brainstorm this." So we put finger limes in the ice cream and on our seafood, and it was time to start creating our own sort of beverages as well. So we created the cider. So we're using Davidson plum from in Atherton Tablelands, locally grown Whitsunday lemon myrtle. And we're popping in about a teaspoon to a schooner's size of the Yungala rainforest-grown finger lime pearls.
Mr. Hansen still supplies Mr. Flack with finger limes, although he says the glut of the fruit is long gone. While he's increased his production over the years, Mr. Hansen says there's no shortage of markets to send his produce to.
So our finger limes this year will double production on last year. So the trees are up now, they're six-year-old trees, so they're getting bigger, they can carry more fruit, so production's up, but so is demand. Shows like MasterChef, the cooking shows, every show has got some sort of bush tucker on it. So it's taken off. I'm getting calls regularly now from restaurant owners around the country. And now he's got demand for them with his cider. We now need to meet that his demand.
But he says demand for bush tucker is starting to outweigh the number of people growing it. He says the lack of producers could be chalked up to the fact that growing bush tucker is challenging and there's not a lot of help available for new growers.
Probably not enough growers at the moment. I think people are slowly getting into it, niche. There's not a lot of information out there, so weed, pest, diseases, you just got to know sort of what you're doing. I'm quite lucky, I've been in the industry all my life, I'm a horticulturalist. I've got a fair idea, but there's no real handbooks out there on how to grow finger limes or how to grow Davidson plum. priority is getting your soils right. So regular soil tests, hitting the sweet spot with your soils, and then the plants can look after themselves.
Mr. Flack's work, transforming these traditional bush foods into alcohol, takes place on the lands of the Yuwibara or Yui people. Traditional Yui custodian Veronica Arwang says she's happy to hear about emerging industries for traditional bush foods.
You know, I think it's amazing that's actually happening, because that's what it's all about. It's about sharing. It's been going on for years. Now, our ancestors taught the first colonials that when they came, you know, they're out of survival on different foods.
But she says she's in two minds about the commercialisation of the products, because the traditional way was just to grow what you needed.
You think about traditional way, cultural way. Everything was just growing wild.
But Auntie Veronica is excited about the prospect of a drink made from one of her favourite foods.
Oh, look, finger limes are my go-to. I just love those. If it's a cider, I'll try it.
That's traditional Yui custodian Auntie Veronica ending that story from Ashley Bagshaw. Well, let's end on a yarn that might just make you smile. A Hobart flower grower has landed in a little bit of hot water, unknowingly growing restricted for local florists. Local state authorities contacted her after apparently seeing photos of the pink blooms on Instagram. They turned up at her property the next day, confiscated the lot, taking them from her flower patch. The ABC's Fiona Breen turned up soon after that and chatted to Katie Dixon about the surprising turn of events.
So I had some really beautiful poppies, nice and tall, pink, frilly, gorgeous flower heads, and I had an unexpected call from Depiwi last week saying that they'd seen some of my photos on Instagram and thought and suspected that they were restricted poppies, that you need a license to grow in Tasmania. So yeah, that was a bit of shock because I had no idea.
What a surprise. So obviously you hadn't intended to plant those sort of poppies.
No, I didn't. So I was growing them purely for the wedding events, and I had absolutely no idea. They were seeds that I sourced, you know, from an Australian seed supplier. So I thought that they were okay. I guess it's probably a really good reminder before you plant anything to always check and check with the botanical names.
How can you check?
Well, that's a good question, because after I got the initial contact from Depiwi, I did have a look on their website and I couldn't find the information easily. But they do have, pertaining to poppies specifically, a Know Your Poppies fact sheet, which has some pictures on it. But again, I think it could be made a little bit easier to find.
Were you surprised that you managed to buy these poppies? I mean, was there any suggestion that their seeds should be restricted?
No, none. And I did have another variety of poppy growing here, which the seed packet's botanical name was Poppy Oriental. And they are okay to grow. But when the guys from Depiwi came last week and took some plant samples to UTAS for testing to confirm exactly what they were, the Oriental poppy was actually, in fact, a different poppy, and it's one of the restricted ones as well. So that's been removed too.
So it wasn't Oriental?
It wasn't an Oriental, no, but sold as an Oriental.
Oh, my goodness. Do you think others may have fallen into this trap?
Yes, I do, actually. I think, I've seen a lot of these poppies in backyards and they're a cottage garden favourite. So, yeah, I think there's probably quite a few around.
Were you surprised, one, that you got the call, and two, that they came round and pulled them out?
I was surprised because I actually had no idea that poppies or certain poppies were restricted. Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised and that they did move very swiftly. But given what I know now and how, you know, I've spoken with Depiwi and they've talked to me about why they're restricted and the dangers involved in ingesting these type of poppies, I think it's a very good thing that they did do that.
Okay, so these were poppies that are used by the poppy industry to produce thebaine and opium.
Correct.
For the drug industry.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it's a very, very tightly held, restricted crop. And yeah, I mean, I guess in the wrong hands with the wrong intention, they'd be really dangerous.
So how do you feel after all this?
Well, I'm really relieved it happened now and not next year, because I was planning on doing another two rows. So I'm glad it saved me from all that work to have it ripped out.
That's Kate Dixon, a flower grower on the outskirts of Hobart, chatting to the Tasmanian Country Hour's Fiona Breen about those restricted poppies she planted mistakenly. So rather than supplying florists with bridal bouquets, it was actually the authorities that were knocking on her door. That story is on our website now. Just put in ABC Rural into any search engine. It'll take you right there. Thanks for your company for today and for the week. Amy Phillips will be back in the saddle on Monday, so you can tune into her at midday. Otherwise, you can check out our podcast. Just put in ABC Queensland Country Hour and it'll take you to where you can listen to our podcast. Thanks to Ellie Bradfield for her help, as well as Kelly Buchanan. Have a safe and happy weekend. It's news time now. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.